been going on tonight. I feel lucky just to be in the room. It's been great. So I'm going to begin the reading by reading a small poem. It's, I think, very lucky that yesterday, over the weekend, that the verdict in the Rodney King case came out to be at least, if not totally, on the side of justice, at least halfway. And I was kind of concerned about that because it was I was driving back on Friday night from Long Island. And I heard Mayor Bradley talk about, he was giving that kind of speech that sort of made you think that he already knew what the verdict was and was going to be bad. You know, it was sort of like, keep cool, no matter what happens, you know, be calm, don't worry about it. You know, as if he already knew what the bad news was going to be, but it turned out not to be as bad as it was going to be. But because of course my concern was that of course coming to if it wasn't going to be had it turned out to be that they got acquitted again, I didn't know what was going to happen. But I want to dedicate this first poem to Gerald Early, and the reason I want to do this is because I heard a story this afternoon about some incident that he went through in a mall. He was basically in a mall and shopping, and what happens is that his wife is at one end of the mall, and he's listening to the security guys talk about a lone black male walking through the mall, and it's like it takes her a while to figure out that they're actually talking about her husband, you know. So this suspicious guy walking through the mall, and they stop him in the end, and it's like, and so it was like one of those things that you constantly get aware of and constantly are reminded of, no matter who you are and what you've gotten, your PhD, your degrees, your paraphernalia that you have to carry yourself through the world, you're still black in this culture. So I thought I'd dedicate this poem to him. It's a true story that happened to me when I was teaching at William & Mary. It's called The Grin. I saw it on the mouth of a plainclothes cop at the Norfolk airport, running from the gate to the taxi stand, made me his business. A black man bolting for an exit is a sweet suspicion. Will you cooperate? He asked. It wasn't a question. That was the first time. When it happened again, same circumstances, same face, I realized the grin on it, barely held in check, was his trademark. He let me go. See you soon, he said to all of us. This is called, this next one's is called Gratitude, and just to be brief about it, it's about a number of things. Again, sort of to follow up on that first poem. So it's about that realization of who you are in a society, and also just as if you're a black poet, which is, I think, is one of the most wonderful, high wire jobs in the in the world. But also that you come to a realization at a certain point that you're not here. You're here because of other people that came before you, you know. I'm not here because I had invented myself. I'm here because there's a lot of other people that came before me that I've never met. I will never meet, but I know that, you know, that I wouldn't. My existence is here because of a lot of other people, and I want to say thank you. I want to say thank you to those people. Some people that I know, some people that I don't know, and also the idea of making that declaration of who you are in this culture, how difficult that is. Anyway, this is called Gratitude. I'm here to tell you an old story. This appears to be my work. I live in the world, walk the streets of New York, this dear city. I want to tell you, I'm 36 years old. I have lived in and against my blood. I want to tell you I am grateful because, after all, I am a black American poet. I'm 36, and no one has to tell me about luck. I mean, after a reading, someone asked me once, if you weren't doing this, what, if anything, would you be doing? And I didn't say what we both understood. I'm a black American male. I own this particular story on this particular street at this particular moment. This appears to be my work. I'm 36 years old, and all I have to do is repeat what I notice over and over. All I have to do is remember. And to the famous poet who thinks literature holds no small musics, love. And to the publishers who believe in their marrow, there's no profit on the fringes, love. And to those who need the promise of wind, the sound of branches stirring beneath the line, here's another environment poised to open. Everyone reminds me what an amazing odyssey I'm undertaking, as well they should. After all, I'm a black American poet, and my greatest weakness is an inability to sustain rage. Who knows what'll happen next? This appears to be one for the books if you train your ears for what's unstated beneath the congratulations. That silence is my story, the pure celebration and shock of my face defying its gravity, so to speak. I claim this tiny glee not just for myself, but for my parents who shook their heads. I'm older now than my father was when he had me, which is no big deal, except I have personal knowledge of the wind that tilts the head back. And I claim this loose seed in the air glee on behalf of the social studies teacher I had in the 10th grade, a real bastard who took me aside after class the afternoon he heard I was leaving for a private school, just to let me know he expected me to drown out there, that I held the knowledge of the drowned man, the regret of ruined flesh in my eyes, which was fair enough, except I believe I've been teaching far longer now than he had that day, and I know the blessing of a narrow escape. And I claim this rooster pulled down morning glee on behalf of anyone who saw me coming and said yes, even when I was loud, cocky, insecure, even when all they could have seen was the promise of a germ, even when it meant yielding ground. I am a bit older than they were when I walked into that room or class or party, and I understand the value of the unstated push. A lucky man gets to sing his name. I have survived long enough to tell a bit of an old story. And to those who defend poetry against all foreign tongues, love. And to those who believe a drop clause signifies encroachment, love. And to the bullies who need the musty air of the clubhouse all to themselves, I am a brick in a house that is being built around your house. I'm 36 years old, a black American poet. Nearly all the things that weren't supposed to occur has happened anyway, and I have a natural inability to sustain rage despite the evidence. I have proof, and the job that comes as simple to me as breathing. This is a club. I'm going to read some of the jazz poems in the book. This is what I think is one of the most adult songs ever written, which is Nobody's Business. Ain't Nobody's Business. And the version that that's in my head is Billie Holiday's version of it. And I say it's one of the most adult songs I've ever written, because even though it's kind of deceptive, because on the one hand, why it's got really poppy melody. You know, da ba da ba ba. And it's supposed to be really sassy when you listen, when you examine the lyrics. If my man beats me on Sunday and I give him all my money on Monday, ain't nobody's business if I do. So I thought I'd just sort of explore that one. Nobody's business. You have cheated me, and I still love you. You have lied, and I still love you. And the neighbors tell me you're nothing but, nothing but, nothing but, and I still love you. Love is dope, love is dope, love is dope, and my degrees wither to paper, and my smart wardrobe slips out of context. You walk over me, and I still love you. You mock me to your friends, and I still love you. I have tasted your hand, and my brother can't tell me, and my mother can't tell me, and my father can't tell me, and my sister can't tell me, and the college can't tell me, and the talk show host can't tell me, and Jesus, Jesus, coming to warn me in my sleep, can't tell me, what the hell, what the hell, I guess there's a police blotter in my future, what the hell, what the hell, I suppose I'll become a mystery corpse, what the hell, the easy smile has its way, baby, 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 baby. Candy, 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 candy. What the hell? What the hell? I guess I'm grown now. What the hell? I guess I'll nurse this bruise. Don't like it? I'm going to read a long poem. And this is about John Coltrane. It's called The Sheets of Sound, and it's about that period where he's just starting to stretch out, getting into that spiritual part of him, sort of expanding that declaration. It's called Sheets of Sound. It's for my friend John Cartier. I thought I'd put that on tape. Sheets of Sound. One. He says, what do I have to lose, actually, by coming right out and saying what I mean to say, like this, and like this, and like this, breathing rickety steps to the heart of the matter, loose a black spirit around the joint, Mr. Coltrane floating a line like this, pushing its muscle, hell, discovering its sweet worth, the sweet worth of pushing any damn wall. This is a necessary lesson. You can make an art out of sailing right over the top, spin a heart clean, if only for these brief seconds, close the world, its silly wounds and hard manners with a yell. I hear you push it, a quote, a necessary lesson. There are gifts, aren't there? You ask, what do I have to lose if I come right out and test it? Peel back the romance in a breath as you reach for what? Surely this love I hear you sing, this sort of love will ruin me. A wonder operates here, pushes away the damn wall as you leap, dresses the shadows in the corners of the room, speaks for you, breezes up your throat, opens. How many times can you do this? Push your losses open. Map the blues's currents. I hear what if color the air with the danger of asking. Two. A man who gives himself a right to speak, a fine spray of what he knows, of where he's been, what has happened to him, an axe which cuts impatient, a loud humility, a spiritual science. Hear it? In the skirt of the fine African-American mother. Hear it in the squeezed life of the black civil servant? Ask the harlequin or the man with the jackal's face. Ask the schoolgirl sharpening a mental knife or the king of the margins with the strength of nations etched by minimum wages. Or little Johnny Volcano spacing in and out of whatever world to have him. Or a long, tall, cool who sparks up only after he folds away his chauffeur's uniform. The dark scholar, obscured by his teeth, diminished each time he laughs. A fine spray of what goes on, who gets swallows, who takes it, who jumps. A concentration of who gives in, who shakes it off. A fine spray of what it might sound like if they could open their lives, if they could blow it out. 3. I hear proof, survival, take a verse. I hear proof, survival, take a verse. I hear proof, survival, take a verse. I hear proof, claim, swing, associate itself. I hear proof, declare, the outer layers slough off. I hear proof's beat, its wide fingers roll seconds on its tips. I hear proof's laugh, a deep glide from the stomach's pit. This is who I am, and this is who I am, and this is who I am. I hear proof's river, the deep bass spring which feeds it, the trance of keyboard light upon water. I hear proof's memory, a torch of calfskins lighting a cave. This is who I am, and this is who I am, and this is who I am. I hear proof gather the sweet, sour berries of its name. I hear proof, survival, take a verse. I hear proof, survival, take a verse. I hear proof, survival, take a verse. Five. I heard a story once told on Miles Davis and the young pup John Coltrane, who was seeking out the master's wisdom, sort of sitting at his feet, so to speak, and he asked Mr. Davis to reveal to him the secret of how to finish a solo. And Miles sort of grunts like a Baptist mother, and he tells Coltrane, take the damn horn out of your mouth. I'm driving with a friend in New Jersey, two poets discussing jazz in a moving vehicle, when the conversation somehow floats over to Coltrane, and for the first time, our talk develops holes. The long and the short of it, you confuse him, John. Come on, is the world really like that at the core all the time? The fee for the search so high? He's referring, of course, to those moments when the only thing between you and dissolving, the only thing that can win you back, is McCoy hemming you in a loose blouse of notes. What about this, my friend wants to know, what do you call it, jazz? It's the spin he puts on the word that sinks everything. 8. A love supreme, but how long can you, how long can you listen to the bullets hitting sanctified tin? You can believe what it must cost him, these thin sheets of hard translation. A black tongue is a coil danger, is trouble, square trouble. A black tongue is a trick mirror, lightning and the fuse. And this beauty is a danger, is a sound called when the water breaks, called what if after murder, after terror, after servitude, after disappearance, after displacement, after short change, after guff. The child's portion, the revised story. The wake-up call got through anyway. 9. Sorry. I tune my ears to my name. I dream what I carry. I taste what can't be swallowed. I shake to what I cry. I come from a long line. My mother canned fruit. My sister used her beauty. My niece inherited my impatience. My brother never found his mine. How do I sing them? We are not sweet. These are lives one walks around, yet locked in the throat, the angels of our gods, claimed and unclaimed choirs. How to admit their song against the world, against the facts, the acquired urge to gaze down. 10. Once I listened to you recreate the world. It was one of your later gigs. You made a few statements. I heard it only once, years ago, and I still remember the way the horns blew primeval slop, which cricketed into gills, wings, fur, roared into a new language, declared itself, reared on its cool black limbs.
You were close to being spent. I heard it only once, an outrage stretched over two sides of a four-sided record. I remember the way the cymbals spat the weather out, seas percussed against the piano's terra firma. I have carried this for years, how we tumble with it, how we can never get it all out.
Since people from the Writer's Voice is here, I'm going to read a poem that I wrote the day after the LA riots happened in LA. I was in there was a meeting going on with the various Writer's Voices across the country that happened to be in Manhattan that afternoon, and as I was about to go to the meeting. My wife called me up. She works in Midtown Manhattan. And she said, everyone's going home early. It was like 2:00, 2:30 in the afternoon. So everyone's gone home. Everyone's leaving home now, you know. So I said, well, what's going on? She said, well, you know, there's going to be these radio reports all day saying, you know, because of the riots that happened the day before, night before. They said there was going to happen in New York, and there was all these different horrible rumors running around. Like Al Sharpton was at the heart of all the rumors. Like one time he was supposedly at Grand Central Station closing that down, and then he was on the bridges and he was closing that down, and then he was on the tunnels and he was pulling that down. He was the boogeyman, you know, you know. And it was the boogeyman. So I got in the cab to go to this meeting. I'm going through Midtown Manhattan in midday, right? And I never seen so much plywood. So much, you know, and the streets were completely empty. Everything was like they were waiting for a hurricane, right? So it turned into a ghost town. And this is the poem that I wrote the day after that. It's a blues poem. It's called Ghost Town. Manhattan is a ghost town. Brooklyn's a ghost town too. Say, Manhattan is a ghost town. Brooklyn's a ghost town too. Everybody's worried about what black folk might do. Lord, up goes the plywood, down comes the steel. Lord, up goes the plywood, down comes the steel. All the shop owners are nervous about the way I feel. The weekend begins early around 57th Street. Say everyone's gone fishing down around 57th Street. Rumors say black folk pissed off and on the way. It's a sight they don't want to meet. Jury told Rodney King what a black man's supposed to do. Jury told the nation what a black person's expected to do. Now nothing's emptying the streets. Nothing's coming after you. Like I said, it's really, I'm glad that at least something happened with the, at least two of them, at least Kuhn and Kuhn and Powell, right, who got it? At least they got it, but it was really, what can I say? It's a really, really just an incredible moment. And this last 2 years have been an incredible 2 years in this country. So this is some of the poems that came out of that first, shock. Anger. I am trying to calm down again. I am forcing myself to think of the plants in my wife's garden. I am trying to avoid confrontation. I am living in fear of nuance. It has been a very difficult few weeks, these days after the verdict in the LA riots. Last night, after watching some spin doctors do their stuff, I reached for my pen. I was going to write a letter to the op-ed page when I stopped and thought about it. It would be difficult to stuff my anger into an envelope, harder still, even dangerous, to send it through the U.S. postal system. I have an anger that could, as they say, lay waste the planets. I have an anger that could only converse with volcanoes. It is surly and diffident and doesn't care to talk about it. Oh, haughty anger. Oh, dark sunglassed angel repository. Oh, unreasonable man. All that would spill onto the mailroom floor would amount to an inarticulate sputter. That's what I told myself. But now as I sit in the backyard, dark beer in my hand,
a sun shining on flowers I would have called normal last month, I hear a voice. The Book of Rules. A few weeks after the L.A. riots, I found myself in Maryland at a writers' conference. During a one-on-one critique of a participant's work, I was given a poem by a middle-aged white woman in the voice of a young black mother. Here's what her poem said. How can I tell my children about how the world operates now? What she wanted to know from me was, would a black woman really say that? Am I being too naive? And I thought about the young mother I had seen on one of the networks. What was she saying about the world as she stood in front of a building that was being looted before the camera? I think she asked, what can I do against this? The angry laughter freeing up behind her reminded me of the rage my sister felt towards my father. Years and years of feeling small, denied, until it became a hurt beyond language, a hurt you couldn't explain to an outsider's satisfaction. I thought I saw on the streets, but my sister's attitude seemed to be in the bank as we divvied up my father's accounts after he died. If I can't have your love, I can damn well have your money. Would a black woman say this? Would she try to keep the blues away from her children? And when the world crashes in, as the blues always teaches you it will, would her heart turn down? Would she ask for the name of this sorrowful place she found herself in? Cry for the Book of Rules? The Killing Floor. It just isn't fair. I read and watch and hear after the tit-for-tat incident after the verdict in L.A., the poor white man who was dragged out the cab of his truck and beaten nearly to death as the cameras whirled above in a traffic helicopter. It isn't easy to watch the little dance a kid in shorts gives as he gets his boots in. He's a tiny rumber of death, long-legged and gangly in the way only a teen can move. He's the shadow of a crazed stork. And oh, strange mirror, how they quickly took the hint as they recite the jury's translation. Do you mean this? Asked their boots and clubs. Asked their arms, which has plucked a stranger into helplessness. Anytime, any place, just because. Nobody's fault but mine. On TV, a cop is trying to explain to us what is actually occurring in the Rodney King videotape. Don't believe your eyes, he tells the host. He claims it's all Rodney's fault, that Rodney actually controls the events by not staying down. This is the theory the first jury bought, and this cop is on the air to give us a blow-by-blow rationalization. The main point being, Rodney didn't seem to understand the drill. He kept trying to rise and get away, and at one point, the officer stops the tape to let us all in on a small revelation. By then, I have forced myself to stop counting the number of times poor Rodney King's body has informed his lizard brain that he is in big trouble, mortal danger, that it's night, that he's alone, surrounded and being beaten by cops, screaming proof that his ass is theirs, is grass, that there will be no other witnesses besides the police. Which blow convinces him that this is his death, come tripping on a run, death raining down hard as blues upon his amazed skull, a cruel, strangely impersonal judgment being placed upon his forsaken bones. How many times does Rodney King's wrecked body scream at him, this is for real, you'd better get up and run for your life, until his injuries take on a kind of dumb luck. He finally becomes too hurt to move. Just at the moment, the cop freezes the action, informs everyone that had Rodney rose once more, they would have been forced to draw their weapons, take off the kid gloves. The rest of these poems are about my family. Empty Choice Blues. Some folks will tell you the blues is a woman, some type of supernatural creature. My mother would tell you, if she could, about her life with my father, a strange and sometimes cruel gentleman. She would tell you about the choices a young black woman faces. Is falling in with some man a deal with the devil in blue terms, the tongue we use when we don't want nuance to get in the way, when we need to talk straight? My mother chooses my father after choosing a man who was, as we sing it, of no account. This man made my father look good. That's how bad it was. He made my father seem like an island in the middle of a stormy sea. He made my father look like a rock. And is the blues the moment you realize you exist in a stacked deck? You look in a mirror at your young face, the face my sister carries, and you know it's the only leverage you got. Does this create a hurt that whispers, how are you going to do? Is the blues the moment you shrug your shoulders and agree a girl without money is nothing, dust, to be pushed about by any old breeze? Compared to this, my father seems, briefly, to be a fire escape. This is the way the blues works its sorry wonders, makes trouble look like a feather bed, makes the wrong man's kisses a healing. My mother's blues about the numbers. My mother didn't get to keep much in her life. She tells me the story of the one time she hit big on the numbers, guessed it and hit it, and then somehow lost it all to my father and cousin. Perhaps she trusted my father once too often and allowed him to pick up her winnings. Maybe she fell asleep a winner and woke up to an empty wound of a hiding place, a dream of greedy, prying hands that wasn't a dream, a crime too soft to wake her up. She's waited for years for them to own up. They laugh that laugh that says, a woman can't prove nothing. My father's dead. She's waiting now for my cousin to come forward. But a man will never lift a woman towards the truth. That's what these blues say, that a woman must carry to her moldering ground. The last argument I had with my father, he died of diabetes about 2 years ago. The last argument I had with my father, the man wants junk food, and he's not supposed to have it. I'm trying to argue the point with my father, who has been in the hospital too long. He wants sugar and salt on his diabetic tongue. The doctor told me I can eat anything I want. What a lie, I tell him. You must be in bad shape. You can't even tell a good lie. And we're both bothered by this fact. I hear the blues' first stirrings, but I keep it to myself. The man wants potato chips. I know I can eat them. I find out this old fox has been bribing his nurses, worrying them to go down to the vending machines. As usual, I'm not with the program. My foot is down, his charm is up. I don't remember who calls the nurse to settle things. No, she says, but a few chips can't hurt. Get me a bag, he orders. And as I head for the door, he grins, and get her a bag too. Motherless children. How many ways do I want to kill this woman, this young bureaucrat at the Office of Social Services, for wanting to kill me? Kill me slowly, by degrees. Kill me with provisions. Kill me in measured words. Kill my mother by rubbing her sad life with my father in my face. Oh, how this woman, bored, dulled by repetition, wants my mother officially rendered inert, reduced to a mere border in a broken-down ghetto house, how she wants the word bastard to define our conversation. What did I do or say? Who knows? But I do know this look she's giving me after telling me that there's no place for my mother's well-being in their guidelines, that as far as they're concerned, she isn't even legally a part of my family. I know this look. This woman wants to observe a screamer, a ripper. She wants her dreams of a babbling monkey to rise. Blow up, she whispers, as she explains what she isn't going to do for me, how my father's bound to disappear item by item, first his house, then his cars, then all his money, except for what it takes for a pine box and a hole. She thinks she's the facts of life, a wall with no apparent handholds, the river referred to in the old spirituals, deep, wide, fraught with many sorrows, and her eyes dare me to become a nigger and kick over the table. Papa was a rolling stone. A few weeks before my father died, my sister tells me a fuzzy story about a young woman who she learned rumors about, she heard rumors about a class or two ahead of her in high school who carried our unusual last name. And when my niece goes through some of my father's papers, she uncovers a small laminated card, a birth certificate from a Midwestern state for a boy born a year before I was, though it's a different last name. What about this, we want to know, and we badger my father in the hospital until he finally admits to us that the woman my sister tried but never got to meet in high school was indeed our half-sister. My father tells us that when my niece was just an infant and my sister was living away in Florida, he'd bundle my niece up and take her to this woman's apartment. He was that proud of being a grandfather, and he knew my niece would be too young to remember. She married a rich man, and they moved away to Israel. It's as far as he's willing to take us on this. She's happy, and I don't want to bother her. And the birth certificate? I see language in the way the bones in his thin body twist. His mouth says, beats me. He's pissed off that it's come down to this, that his children would have enough time to try and unravel a man's business. And then he clucked, which I took to mean, what makes you think I owe you this? Tramp. I need a haircut, but this guy clearly doesn't understand what's on my head. I become nervous when I see a blank stare as I try to explain to him what a slow fade is. What can I say about the history of my hair? Once I had a poetry manuscript which had the word nappy mixed somewhere in the title. Once I wore different floppy hats. Once you could set my blood to boil by simply putting an afro pick from out of a back pocket, rake a soft dew as if God played fashion favorites. In high school in the late 60s, wasn't our afros mythical? Didn't George Jackson die because some guards believe his hair was capable of storage? Little bush of anger, tiny grove of long hidden blades. How many times did my family think a proper haircut would put my feet on the right path, set my mind straight? Once my father got a cousin who was a back alley barber to relax my hair. When he was finished with the uneven line and before he cut it, I was able to look in the shard of mirror, see that my hair happened to be longer than my mother's, all that wound up energy given permission to roll, to blow in a breeze. I was so pissed off by this cure that I let it go to hell, let it tangle into long, vengeful dreads that I wasn't a cut off until I began teaching college, and only then because the school's down south. Some friends innocently recommended this new hair place that's a few blocks away from my house. The barber's friendly and game, but he's up against homeboy hair, urban steel wool, industrial strength kink. We both act as if we're on a bad blind date, well-intentioned but soon forgotten. I leave $40 lighter, a few snips cleaner, and carrying the memory of one of my dear aunts who didn't know what to make of this mess either. It's only a paper moon. Did daddy ever take you out dancing, I asked my mother as we sit watching the soaps in the living room. I heard a story from one of my aunts about my parents' early days together, something about a double date my aunt went along on to a dance hall. My mother either doesn't remember it too well or has decided against letting me in too closely on this one. No, it wasn't me. It must have been some other woman, she grumps. He would take her out to the movies, though. Once, she even browbeated him into taking her to see the Mills Brothers. And I'd forgotten what a big deal they once were. She tells me that it was an event that was talked about weeks before the concert at the hotel she was working at as a maid. It was an event large enough to test the mettle of a young couple. When her friends on the job asked, "Are you going, Elvita?" It was clearly a question about her man. And it felt good to hear that at least once my father did her right. Did they laugh easy there? Did they clap and shout off the low wage week? Did the brothers sing my mother's favorite song, Paper Moon? Her favorite song. It's a question I'd never thought to ask until this moment. And now, as she answers, I notice her eyes as they swing back, and I hear her recite a hidden line or two until suspicion slams the door. And these are the last ones. I know I'm losing you. Have you ever touched your father's back? No, my fingers tell me. As I try to pull up a similar memory, there are none. This is a place we have never traveled to, as I try to lift his weary body onto the bedpan. I recall a photo of him standing in front of our house. He is large, healthy, a stocky body in a dark blue suit. And now his bowels panic, feed his mind phony information. And as I try to position him, my hands shift, and the news shocks me more than the sight of his balls. Oh, bag of bones, this is all I'll ever know of his body, the sharp ridge of spine, the bed sores, the ribs rising up in place like new islands. I feel him strain as he pushes for nothing, feel his fingers grip my shoulders. He is slipping to dust, my hands inform me. You'd better remember this. A little bit of soap. One of the things my father never liked about me was my dark skin. Used to be so pretty, was the way he put it. And it was true. There is proof. A baby picture of a curly-haired, just a hair's breadth away from fair-skinned child, me. My small fingers balled up into fists. And then, as if some god shrugged and suddenly turned away its gaze, something caved in. And I was dark. Dark. And all that it implied. So what happened? My father always seemed to want me to somehow explain. What did this desertion mean? The skin that seemed born to give up, this hair that crinkled to knots, this fairy tale-like transformation. You used to look real good, my father, a man of slightly lighter hue, would say to me, his son, his changeling. Maybe you ought to wash more. One kind favor. My father is close to death, and in his final hours, he begins his journey by asking anyone within earshot of his bed for a few things. He asks to be allowed to go back home to Florida. He asks to be able to cast off his dreary hospital gown, to be reunited to the shape of his own clothes. He wants someone to fetch him his shoes, now useless for weeks, the impossible act of slipping them on, the slight miracle of bending and tying. In his wishes, my mother arrives and sits at his bedside, or he changes it, and he walks back into his house, into the living room, his old chair. He is so close to dreaming now, and his body lifts with the desire to fix things. Fetching bones. My father's a sealed tin of dust riding in the trunk of my rental car. My sister and niece are in the back seat, and I choose not to inform them of this. Later, I will meet with my cousin at the church where the memorial service was held. I will sit the box on the curb while we talk. I am carting around the rubble of the man who loved to call me stupid, who made my sister feel like nothing, who drove my mother nuts. I have done this in order to shave a few dollars off the funeral course, I tell myself, as a small part of me gives in, fans the smoldering pleasure. Soothe me. What happened to my money? My father asked us towards the end of one of my visits to the hospital, and I think he must mean the large wad of cash he loves to flash and carry, the only leverage he thinks an old black man has over the world, the thing I love the least about him, skinflint, miser, money grubber, tight-fisted ruler of the house. But no, it's smaller. He's talking petty cash. Look over there in that drawer, he says. Don't you see it? I see just what I expect. Tongue depressors, baby oil, the diabetic candy he sniffed at and left by the side of the road. If there was any cash there, it was long gone. A secret boon for some nurse or orderly, a justifiable tax for a hard-ass patient. So why don't I tell him the truth? Instead, I reach in my wallet, ask him, you mean this? And he watches me as I do and believes it. He robs me of $20 and I let him. I remember the strength left in his fingers, the way they clamped around the bill. If it was a kiss, we'd tease, who's your girlfriend? If it was a moment in a song, the lyric would sing, without you, I'm nothing. Okay, one, two, three more. A rag, a bone, and a hank of hair. I'm sitting alone with my father at the funeral parlor, Viewing hours have just begun, but it's midday work week, and for a few hours, it'll just be me and him. The first time I've laid eyes on him since the phone call woke me up. I'm doing what a son is supposed to do, or so I've been told, but it's hard work, sitting with what used to love and trouble you. Of course, his body is a bright lie in his casket. Everything that has brought him here, carefully hidden or rearranged. Is there something I want to tell him? Anything I can forgive? I can only sit and wait and listen to the gospel music as it buzzes through the speakers. Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. All his time, all his struggles that I still call life, all his trials. I just want to testify. There was at the end a look of great peace on my father's face at the moment of his death. At the memorial service, my cousin tells the story to us as a way to infer a last-minute salvation, a meeting of Jesus in the middle of the air, this being, after all, the AME Zionist Church across from the vacant lot that used to be the elementary school me and my sister attended. This is the part of the service when we stand up for him, this small knot of family and friends in a very large room. He's gone and left my mother with nothing. Her name isn't on the deed to the house. Her name never appears on his policies. Her mind's confused. She can't take care of herself by herself, and I'm having a real hard time convincing various agencies that she even exists, which is why there's no casket to bear. Too expensive, we decide. Money to be better spent on the living, on my mother. Still, we give him a family send-off. A hard man, but his own man, sings the testimonies. A stingy man, but a family man. And I truthfully thank him for the roof he put over our heads, staying when a lot of other men took a look at their wives, their babies, their house bills, and changed their names to fare thee well. And then my sister stands up through the pain and accidents of first born, first torn, stands up, the family's bad girl, the willful daughter.